Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Michael Ponzo. I'm here on behalf of Casper's Smoke Shop. Please let me know if you can't have any trouble with audio. I'm on the phone today. And I'd like to also reserve a minute for a rebuttal today. The issue we're appealing is the issue of whether or not the court improperly usurped the role of the jury by granting summary judgment and not allowing the tort of bad faith to go to the jury. Now, in Arizona, we found that the issue of fair debatability on an insurance claim is just not sufficient to avoid a bad faith claim, and it takes more. And so in this case here, the court should have followed the rule that the appropriate inquiry is whether or not there was sufficient evidence from which reasonable jurors in this case could have concluded the investigation, evaluation, or the processing of the claim by Atlantic was proper, that they acted reasonably and either knew or were consciously aware of the fact that it wasn't reasonable.
Counsel, may I interrupt? I fully appreciate the standard in Arizona, which you've laid out clearly in your brief. You have a half a dozen different points that you think, amount to evidence from which a reasonable juror could have found that standard met. Can you tell me, what do you think is the strongest evidence of bad faith that should have been allowed to go to the jury?
I think the lack of follow-on investigation. Once you had competing views on the level of damage, Your Honor, we had Brown O'Haver, who came in at damages in the area of $200,000, whereas in the Atlantic was tying themselves to the resolution at $15,000. It was incumbent on the insurance company to go back and say, hey, we have these two disparate views. We should do a further investigation on it. They didn't do a further investigation. I think secondly to that is whether or not you gave equal consideration. When we have situations like this in the insurance world, we quite often have vendors whose livelihood is completely tied to the goodwill of the insurance companies. And we always have these conflicts, just in this case here, where you have a vendor who comes up with a level of information that the client disagrees with. That forced them to go to Brown O'Haver and get a different opinion. So once we had this conflict of arguments as to the value of the property, what's salvageable, what's non-salvageable, and why Atlantic decided
counsel, your view is that the company provided a choice of appraisers. The insured picked one. The appraiser came out with a value. The insured disputed it. That in every circumstance, in order to avoid a bad faith claim, the insurer must conduct a substantial subsequent investigation beyond reading the appraiser's report and deciding that it's objectively reasonable?
What I would say, Your Honor, is that in a situation like this, where you have two disparate points of view on it, that the insurance company cannot just simply select the point of view that aligns with their interest. So whether they agree with resolution or they disagreed and brought in the second person, a party, and said, and found someone that disagreed with it, that's insufficient. Okay, the question gets down to the reasonableness. So when they're looking at this claim and they have two different opinions, what's the reasonable thing to do? Would it be reasonable? And that is a question that should have gone to the jury, and the jury should have decided whether or not they thought they acted reasonably by aligning with one of the entities that the agent of the insurance company recommended. We have to remember that these parties, Casper, these are not sophisticated individuals. They have a fire. They don't know who to go to for remediation. They don't know who to consult with. They rely heavily on the insurance companies. The insurance company will come back and tell you people that they've worked with, and then they go select it. It's when they have a conflict and they disagree with the findings of that individual, the insurance company needs to do more. It can't just simply say, aha, I have something that aligns with my interests, and based on that, I'm going to go off and deny the claim. I'm not going to move forward on it. So in my opinion, I think, based on the circumstances, when you have this conflict of interest, the insurance company has to do more than simply say, I found somebody that aligns with me. That makes it fairly debatable. Thus, I don't get the bad faith. Our Supreme Court disagrees with that. It takes more than just finding the ability to rely on one vendor. It's, was that reasonable?
Could I ask a question about that? Is it the BOH evaluation that you think raised this need for a tie-breaking evaluation?
Well, I think two things. I think, first of all, the client disputing in the first place, and I think the BOH evaluation. And the other side with the BOH evaluation is, as the court knows, this did go to trial. And the jury did find that the number, you know, they found a number of $94,000 of additional damages above and beyond the damages that the Atlantic found.
Well, we know that now. We know that now. Yeah. But if you could focus on what was before the district court, right, and at the time, I'm concerned if I could just get you to go back to BOH, because it seems to me that's what's triggering your argument. And my understanding from the record is that BOH didn't do an independent evaluation. Do I have that wrong?
The BOH did not do it. I don't know the extent of the independent evaluation that BOH did. BOH is a public adjuster, Your Honor.
And didn't BOH simply pick the retail value or pick the value for the DVDs that was simply given them by the owner without doing any independent investigation at all to determine if that number was right or wrong?
Yes, they chose a number, but again, we have to look at the situation here.
They chose the number given them by the insured.
By the insured or the insured's representative, Mr. Sage. And the issue we have to understand here, Your Honor, is this is kind of a unique little convenience store. They're a local convenience store. They're not like a Circle K. They're, you know, they have everything from, I'm sorry to say, porn DVDs, the hookah pipes, the things that serve that market. So they did go to the representative, find out what the value of that was, and BOH did rely on that value. But again, the owner
and later, if I'm reading his deposition correctly, the owner specifically testified that basically, this isn't actually the value that I mark them up three times what I paid for them, and that's the number I gave BOH. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's effectively correct.
So that was before the district court at the time it ruled that there was no evidence from which a jury could find that it was unreasonable not to credit that evaluation, which involved no investigation into the value.
Well, you're just talking about the DVDs in that case. And it is, and the fact that he bought the DVDs, he bought them for a price and he marks them up. This is a client who would go to Los Angeles and buy off the street a lot of their products. So what they bought them for and what they marked them up for and what they would sell them for is something that the owner can testify to, as well as the owner's representative, which was Mr. Sage.
And what value was the insurance company required to pay off on? Was it retail value or was it something else?
It would be retail value, Your Honor.
Value? Wait a minute. This is important. I thought it was the replacement value of the inventory. Forgive me for interrupting, Judge Bennett.
No, that was not really my question.
Oh, I should have let you ask it. My apologies.
No.
Okay. When you look at the breach of contract and you look at the bad faith claim, you're going to have two different types of damages, okay? The replacement value would be under the breach of contract. The bad faith value would be the multiples of it. So, in other words, that is the lost profit that this store had by losing out on all that inventory. But the fact is that the DVDs are only a portion of the BOH number. And I know the court is talking about whether or not it was reasonable, but we do have a jury that found that those calculations were correct, more so than the calculations provided by the insurance company by resolution. And the other issue gets down to not only just the value of it, what was salvageable and what was not salvageable. So now it's not just a difference of the price, it's the difference of what could be salvaged and what could not be salvaged. And the position that we had was the vast majority of the items, both retail items and business personal property, were not salvageable items at all.
That's evidence, so counsel, that's evidence that you presented before the jury. And it looks like you presented it successfully. But to be candid, and I want to give you a chance to respond, it struck me that earlier there was a different record before the district court.
Well, the record before the district court did include the Mr. DeLuise's testimony that the product was not that he smelled smoke and it wasn't salvageable. So we had that before the court. The issue then is, you know, the dispute in this case has always been, you know, what's salvageable, what's not salvageable, and then what's the value of all of it?
And so since your time is ticking, forgive me, but if your time really is running down. And so okay. This is why I asked you initially, I want to make sure I've got it. What's your strongest evidence of bad faith that you think should have been allowed to go to the jury? And I think you told me it was the failure to do the subsequent investigation once your client objected. Is there more?
Is there more? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you wanted to go back to that one point.
I'm trying to get your best answer about what you think, why you think the district court erred by dismissing the bad faith.
I think where the district court erred because the district court made judgments that the jury should have been allowed to make. The district court should have been able to evaluate the testimony of the Brown O'Haver people. The district court should have been allowed, the jury should have been allowed to evaluate the testimony of the others and decide who was being reasonable and how they did it. The other side, Atlantic, is fully able to cross-examine them on any other of the issues on Fire's credibility. And as I said before, what we do know is when that happened, we have a record that shows a reasonable jury did that. And so my point is that the court usurped that.
Counsel, in Arizona, like most jurisdictions, you have to show a lot more to prevail on that faith claim than you do on a breach of contract claim. Not every breach of contract claim by an insurer equals bad faith. You need objectively unreasonable conduct, not just that you're wrong.
Right. But that's really a decision for the jury to make. And the jury would have been allowed to look at this and say, you paid $15,000, we awarded $94,000 more. Why did they do that? What didn't they consider? Was it reasonable for that position? And my argument is that that's something the jury should have been allowed to do, not the court.
Counsel, did you want to reserve some time for your rebuttal?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Your Honor.
You bet. We'll hear from opposing counsel, please.
Thank you. May it please the court. A central, basically undisputed aspect of the record of this case, critical to both Casper's appeal and Atlantic's cross appeal, is that throughout the adjustment of the claim, up to the date the lawsuit was filed, and even through a year of discovery, Casper never contended and never disclosed a claim that the business personal property had not been properly cleaned by resolution. Now, Judge Bennett asked about the referral of an appraiser, and at the risk of correcting your honor, it wasn't a referral of an appraiser by Atlantic.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was a remediation company. And
yes, I misspoke. If I said that, I beg your pardon. There were three suggestions, right?
I think I misspoke, Judge Kristen.
Yes.
Oh, okay, good. We'll let you take that one.
I'll take full blame.
Well, and it is because appraisers become involved later in the case. But at that point, it was a remediation company. So Casper had
But I have a follow-up question about that. Forgive me. I have a follow-up question about that because it seems that there were three choices, and I'm trying to figure out whether or not Casper knew from the outset that it was choosing someone or an entity resolution that was going to assess and then do the follow-up cleaning after they had sorted it into salvageable and non-salvageable. Was that disclosed to Casper?
Yes. Casper knew that they had a choice. And indeed, the record through, I believe, the deposition of Mr. Mosher and the deposition of William Say confirmed that Casper actually rejected one of those companies because they had a problem with that company in the past about another matter having to do with vandalism in the neighborhood before this fire ever occurred.
But Mr. Bell, I don't think we're not communicating. My question's different.
Okay.
They're arguing a conflict of interest because resolution was both going to sort these items into salvageable and non-salvageable piles, if you will, and then had the contract to do the cleaning for what was deemed salvageable. So they had an interest. That's the implied argument, right? They had an interest to deem more of it salvageable than was reasonable. And I'm trying to figure out whether they knew that resolution was going to serve both roles.
Well, the contract itself, which is one of the exhibits, plainly states that, and this was signed by Mr. Say on behalf of Casper. The contract itself says We're being hired to pack out the contents, inspect them, and clean them. That's in the
contract. And that was true of the other choices as well, other than resolution, the other nominees?
I would understand from the evidence, Your Honor, that Mr. Stay did not get that far in the process with either other company. He met with the representative of Resolution, decided to go with him, and did not see a contract from the other two choices.
So the order that you believe the evidence is the contract laid this out, he signed the contract, and his objections came after their number, not when he saw the contract that they were going to do both.
His objections came after he saw the, after, well, there was, at the time of the motion for summary judgment, what was, well, no, this was part of the record as well. There was a dispute as to when he signed the contract. According to Resolution, they would not have done any work without a signed contract. And so the evidence coming from Resolution was he signed it before they did any work, including the pack out. According to Mr. Say, he contended when I took his deposition that he did not see that contract and sign it until the pack out has already occurred. So there was that dispute in the evidence between Resolution and Mr. Say. But again, throughout the course of the whole claim, before the lawsuit was filed, even through a year of litigation, Casper never came forward and said, we contend that Resolution did not properly clean what they took out of the store. Their contention was always Casper, that their Resolution should never have attempted to clean anything. And they objected to anything being included in a salvageable list to be calculated on that basis. That was the contention. And that was as confirmed by Mr. Mosher, as confirmed by Mr. Say during that period of time. And it wasn't.
So the claim that you knew about was the claim that none of it was properly cleaned?
No, that none of it could be properly cleaned.
Right.
And indeed, there was testimony from Mr. Mosher that he had met with Mr. Say at an inspection at Resolution.
Right.
And Mr. Say didn't raise any issue about the contents not being cleaned. And Mr. Mosher testified that indeed at that inspection he found that the contents had been cleaned. And so Atlantic's understanding through this whole process was their position was you simply can't clean these contents for a retail operation. There's a stigma on all these contents by reason of being there. So Atlantic, you've got to pay for all of them as non-salvageable, and there's no cleaning process that permitted. That was the dispute. And so, and we get to the point that the complaint is filed, and if the court looks at the complaint, all but a line or two of the complaint, all that has to do with is the structural claim and not the property. This lawsuit started on the basis that they were complaining about how Atlantic paid for the structural claims. We get a year into the litigation, and then we start finding out that the real heart of this battle is they're complaining about they weren't properly paid for the business personal property. And it's not until I take the deposition of Mr. Say in February of 2019, more than a year after this lawsuit is filed, that I find out, one, they have the property, and two, at the end of that month, on the eve of the close of discovery, they now contend a new argument that the property had not been cleaned properly by Resolution. So we submit that's central to both, because the court found that the real dispute here was between Resolution and the insured, and Resolution was the company hired by the insured to do the pack up and the cleaning. And as the court properly found, it was undisputed. That was revealed to Atlantic during the claim process. The court found that indeed, because of that dispute, the insured hired Brown O'Haver. Brown O'Haver submitted an additional report that was different than Resolution's. Atlantic said, we find no basis to reject what your remediation company did because this is a public adjuster disputing it. And so since the insured continued to press the point and said, we want to submit this to appraisal, that's when appraisers were involved, and Atlantic said, all right, we agree to submit this to appraisal. and that occurred approximately March through May of 2019.
Do you want to talk about your
March through May of 2017?
Do you want to talk about your motion in limine and the abuse of discretion? Yes. My question is, so you're taken by surprise on February 5th, 2019, during this deposition. There's still 24 days left before discovery closes. Why don't you do something at the deposition or within those 24 days to explore these issues, ask for more documents, request production of documents, file further interrogatories? Because your complaint seems to be you're taken by surprise then you get on the very last day of discovery something from Casper and you can't do anything because discovery is over. But you had at least 24 days to do something.
Two reasons, Your Honor. One, bearing in mind that the MIDP rules that we were operating in the district court in Arizona at that time had been adopted in 2017. And Judge Campbell had been very clear in his pretrial orders and in the extensions that he granted extending discovery that we had to come, that there had to be a basis for any extensions, and he was opposed to extending discovery. He'd already extended it twice. So we had that from Judge Campbell.
But when you say that you were surprised by totally new evidence, a totally new theory, even if you said this order and this alternative discovery plan in Arizona was very rigid, wouldn't you be in a better position to make your argument to us today if you had at least asked to reopen discovery, asked to extend discovery, rather than just saying this order is so rigid we wouldn't even ask the question?
In hindsight, I would agree. We would probably be in a better position. But in 2019, as this was unfolding, we had Judge Campbell's rulings. Bear in mind, the February 4 deposition of Mr. Say provided merely the evidence he was in possession of the property. It did not provide evidence that they now contended that it had to be improperly cleaned. That contention was not added to this lawsuit until February 28, the day of discovery closing. We then deposed Mr. DeLuise several days later and take it up with Judge Campbell at that time about these late disclosures. And Judge Campbell, and I did so at that time, thinking about the motions for summary judgment we plan to file. And Judge Campbell made it very clear he was not going to allow into evidence late disclosed evidence. And looking at the standards and considering the standards of Rule 26, Rule 37, and the MIDP rules, we made the decision, all right, we'll go ahead and file our motion for summary judgment and proceed on the basis that they can't use this evidence. And when they
okay, can you tell me again where in the record that was? Is that in part of the transcript where he said, I'm not going to reopen or whatever he said, but you can raise it again at trial?
We brought it up in reply in support of the motion for summary judgment, because the response to the motion for summary judgment tried to incorporate the Scott DeLuise opinions about his inspection in late February of 2019. We objected to consideration of that as untimely disclosed and pointed out the discussion we had with Judge Campbell. What he did with that, what we did is we asked, we moved to strike it, and we moved for sanctions. And Judge Campbell ruled that because he ruled in favor of us on summary judgment, he denied the motion to strike as also contrary to as unnecessary and contrary to Rule 7, and left it that way. We felt coming out of the motion, we understood coming out of the motion for summary judgment, that evidence wasn't being considered. We get a change of judge, going from Judge Campbell to Judge Teelbert for the trial. Knowing that Judge Teelbert knew the case, I filed the motion in limine. And our contention is Judge Teelbert makes no findings as required by Rule 37 that there was any just reason for their delay in these disclosures. And so it doesn't shift to us to prove harmlessness or prejudice before they make that showing. And Judge Teelburg did not require that of all, even though there is prejudice from the standpoint that had they timely disclosed this evidence at the time the suit was filed, we would have had more than a year to inspect it, to determine whether additional inspections were provided or needed, as opposed to be scrambling to do that after the discovery deadline had passed and asking Judge Campbell to extend discovery.
And what happens if we were to agree with you it was an abuse of discretion? What happens in the district court next on this issue?
We would submit that the judgment from the trial is overturned. The case is returned for trial on the basis that that evidence it can't come into a new trial unless the trial judge finds that Casper had good cause not to disclose it at the time of their initial disclosure, despite the fact that it had in their possession.
Okay, but we are talking about Casper. You're taking issue with the fact that Casper didn't disclose that Casper was in possession of Casper's property.
Correct, Your Honor. I mean, this was something that was supposedly unusable. Their contention was they couldn't sell it, they couldn't do anything with it. They file a lawsuit, again, a lawsuit.
So does that mean you assume that they had thrown it away, or that they declared it a total loss, or that they...
We understood that.
The part that's difficult for me is that you're contending that you didn't have notice that they had their own property after this fire, but of course they had their own property.
Being commercial property that can be disposed of in any number of ways, we understood it was appropriate to proceed on the basis that they're not disclosing they have it. They're not disclosing that there's any defect in its condition in their possession. And again, their whole lawsuit when filed is a lawsuit about the structural claim, not the property claim. It gets a two-line reference. And their initial disclosures are not, here's what's wrong with the property. It's here's what they contend about what's wrong with how we handle the structural claim. And it's not until much later in the case that they begin to develop evidence, and this was at the time of mediation.
Maybe I'm missing something here, but after it was cleaned, where did you think it was, the property that was cleaned?
It remained in Resolution's possession until late in 2017 when Mr. Say went and took it from Resolution after he finished a dispute with Resolution in terms of paying for storing it. We understood that Mr. Say took it sometime in 2017, and at the time they filed a lawsuit and throughout, again, in February of 2018 and new disclosures, nothing is said about it.
So you assumed that it was just gone?
We assumed it was gone. It had been disposed of as a part of a salvage on a post-fire claim. They did with, you know, and they weren't making allegations about it other than that somehow Atlantic didn't properly pay for it. But again, we understood what this, you know, the dispute that had been submitted to appraisal had been, and we understood we were defending a claim on the basis that here was an issue about whether a property could be cleaned or not.
And did you submit an interrogatory to them? Where's the property? What happened to it?
We did not. We pursued that at Mr. Say's deposition, but prior to his deposition, we did not, because again, the disclosure rules that we're working under in Arizona at the time were considered much more expanded and detailed in terms of the information that had to be turned over to the other side. So we would have expected, and we did expect, identification of whatever evidence they had, and they didn't include the property as quote evidence they had.
So there was an affirmative obligation under those disclosure rules that doesn't otherwise exist under the federal rules?
That's correct. That we understood the MIDP rules adopted similar to the Arizona rules, that you have to provide not only evidence for yourself that supports your case, but evidence that's favorable to the defense, anything that's relevant you are required to disclose.
You mentioned two lines in the complaint. I just want to, are you referring to paragraph 5 of the complaint, which explains that I think it would be paragraph 6 of the complaint, forgive me, that a fire occurred causing significant damage to the structure as well as to the goods, inventory, furniture, and other personal property used in connection. So there's notice there. Are there other lines in the complaint?
to my understanding,
that you're referring to.
No, that they're not saying. Well, I think that there is reference to Atlantic not properly paying for the property later.
Yes. All right. Thank you. We've taken you significantly over your time. Counsel, would you like to use your rebuttal?
Yes, I would, Your Honor. I think it's important to note that, you know, Atlantic's counsel admitted that since day one they knew that we contested that the property could not be cleaned. Now, if I had gone off and recommended to my client to go off and destroy that property, we would be sitting here today, Your Honor, on a motion under spoliation that we destroyed the evidence.
So just to make good use of our time, what he said is that what the claim that your client gave notice of was that the property couldn't be cleaned because of a stigma, is what he said. What's the earliest time you gave notice that your position was that the property had not been adequately cleaned, please?
The notice would have been in the complaint under the paragraph you noted, Your Honor. And it was also through the entirety of the litigation. As far as the order that he's referring to from Judge Campbell, there is no order from Judge Campbell on discovery on any of these items here. It seems to be somewhat of an interpretation counsel has that Judge Campbell was going to order this. Judge Campbell never ordered that any of this material would not be allowed into the case. And I think the most telling thing is to understand how Judge Steelberg addressed this is reading the conversation between Judge Steelberg, the testimony, both during the motion in limine as well as during the trial, which is, did you do anything to find out about it? You knew the case was all, it was contesting whether or not the subject were properly cleaned. What did you do? Am I missing something? Okay, so the court, I think there's a good record to understand exactly how Judge Steelberg would have looked at this, how Judge Steelberg made a decision. We're talking about a senior district court judge, and his decisions on the admission of evidence or on discovery, I think, are well supported by the record. And I don't think it's the role here to usurp Judge Steelberg's discretion as a trial court judge to make that decision. And with that,
let me ask you this question. Let's assume for the moment that everything you just said is reasonable and not an abuse of discretion. What about the decision once he allowed your testimony on what the other side is characterized as a new theory? What about the trial judge's decision not even to let them have a rebuttal witness to come in and rebut the testimony that they say they were prejudiced by?
Well, the issue then gets back to any level of disclosure. The fact that he went out there, they could have gone off and disclosed his opinions even before trial. The other thing they could have done is gone to Judge Steelberg and said during the motion limine, will you allow us to go off and do an inspection and disclose this evidence?
I thought they proffered a witness that they wanted to put on the stand as a rebuttal witness, and the judge said, no, you can't do that either.
Because
Mosher was on the stand. I think we're talking about, just to be clear so I can follow this, I think we're talking about Mosher was on the stand in rebuttal, and there was an objection when the question had to do with going out to, I think, see the property in the pawn shop. Is that what you're referring to now, counsel, in response to Judge Friedman's question? I just want to be clear.
I believe both Judge Friedman and I are talking about that question. And the issue was the inspection was done, but then Mr. Mosher didn't disclose any of his opinions before trial. So what you have is exactly, you know, even a more significant argument than counsel is presenting, which is there is no disclosure. There was no prior disclosure of Mr. Mosher's opinions. There was no way for us to prepare for trial to cross-examine him.
But he's a rebuttal witness. The first judge said, I'm denying your motion in limine, but you can raise it again at trial. The new judge, you raise it again at trial. He says, sorry, you lose again, he says to Atlantic. So he lets you go forward and put on your witnesses. And then Atlantic says, well, we've got Mr. Mosher here. And in addition to everything else he was going to testify about, he's prepared to rebut what you allowed over our objection the other day, even though the earlier trial judge suggested that it might not be admitted. It was admitted. And now we have a right to rebut it with something.
Well, the correction I would make, Your Honor, is Judge Steelberg was the judge for both the motion in limine as well as the trial. So it was Judge Teelburg who gave the initial ruling on the motions in limine, and Judge Teelburg who made the decision at trial. So he had the basis of both the arguments of the motion in limine as well as the trial situation to make his decision about what evidence he felt should be allowed in.
Do either of my colleagues have additional questions? All right. Thank you both for your arguments. Counsel, we'll take this matter under advisement and move on to the last case on our calendar for the day.
Thank you, Your Honor.